These are the target files. Journey back with us between the 1970s and 1990s on a TARDIS nostalgia trip as we look back at the novelizations and audiobook releases of classic Doctor Who stories.
Gallifreyan Archive, access granted. Subject, Time Lord known as the Doctor. Target, novelization, Logopolis. Author, Christopher H. Bidmead. Publication, Earth Year, 1982. Fixing the Chameleon Circuit involves a visit to Earth and a trip to the planet, Logopolis. Normally a quiet little place that keeps itself to itself, but on this occasion, the meddling presence of the Doctor's arch-enemy, the Master, ensures the disruption of normality, and even the Master is horrified by the threat of total chaos he unintentionally precipitates, until he finds a way to turn the imminent destruction of the universe to his own advantage.
Hello there, this is the Target Files, and we're going to discuss the novelisation of Logopolis by Christopher H. Bigney, a fourth Doctor novel, and also the audiobook written and read by him as well.
Yes, the fourth Doctor's final story, this one. What do you make of it?
I think it's a definitely interesting one. It's the sort of last story of the fourth Doctor. So it sort of feels quite somber through the whole of it, but it seems a bit too mathematical, because it's, you know, Christopher H. Bigney is a very high interest in science and all that, so it seems quite dry in my opinion.
I think it's a good example of what Doctor Who can be. You know, it can be everything to everybody, can't it? You know, it can have these it can have these mathematical episodes, these are complex scientific ideas, but can also have a bit more of the human drama, can't it, Al? But, you know, Bidmead does his best to put it all together.
Yeah, I think he does a good job at it. But I think the book just seems a bit dry, and it didn't seem to have feeling of that bit at the end and sort of work for me really in the book, where it's brilliant on TV with Tom. But I think everything has its place in Doctor Who land, which is always good.
Yes, I should say, listeners, this is this TV episode is my very first memory of Doctor Who. I think I was 3 going on 4. I remember the picture of the Watcher, the white face, turning into Peter Davison, who was then sort of my first Doctor. At that age, the Doctor didn't really stand out for me at that age. I suppose other characters like Adric and Tegan did, because Tom almost takes a back seat in this story, doesn't he? You know, possibly for a somber reason. Al, would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. It seems to be more the other characters taking over, because see what the consequences are from the Watcher turning up and that. So I think, though, that's a really good twist at the end. I won't say it's spoiling, but I think it works well.
The whole idea of the Watcher, something that hasn't yet been repeated in Doctor Who. What we can say, spoiler-wise, is that there's a great deal of foreboding to that character, isn't
there? I think it's really well done. It's a very simple idea of something's going to happen to the Doctor and slowly drip feeds to the end when something else happens, and it sort of works well, I think.
Yes, it's nicely teased throughout, isn't it, who the Watcher is.
Yeah, I think most definitely sort of don't know if it's the Doctor or it's somebody else, or you know, it's the Master. It's a very well sort of written part of the book. I don't know, do you think all the mathematical stuff just makes it too dry most of the time?
It's a real sort of thinking person's book, Al, isn't it? Not to do ourselves down in terms of what we understand, but it is a real sort of complex
mathematical issue of entropy at the heart of it.
Logic gates and ideas on how TARDIS works now. It's one of these sort of books you have to, I don't know if you found it, the audio book, you had to basically sit there and actually concentrate on it.
Don't suppose it's too flippant a thing to say that you've got to really concentrate on it, because some audiobooks in any sort of realm you can sort of switch in and out of, can't you? But this is one that really demands your attention throughout.
Most definitely, I agree. There are audiobooks you can just sort of put on in the background for, you know, have a nap to or relax to. But this one, you had to physically sit there, and each part of the chapter was connected to another bit, so you had to listen in quite depth to it.
Yes, and the whole central theme of entropy, which generally is that everything decays, isn't it? It's not so much skirted around by Bidmead, but it is quite a complex issue to understand.
Most definitely, it's this whole, you know, the Doctor isn't as infallible as he thinks he is, and empathy is corrupting everything. And there's some great scenes near the end of the one, boy, there's some great scenes in Logopolis where empathy just takes everything and turns it to dust, basically.
Now, talking about these scientific concepts, there are some lovely, fantastical ones. Something that immediately struck me as a youngster, as a very small child watching this, was the idea of being able to shrink people, done in a very sinister manner in this story compared to, say, something like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or the earlier Doctor Who story, Planet of Giants. It's such a sinister way of dealing with people by the Master, isn't it?
I really like that feature of the Master, because he does it with so much nastiness and malevolence, and then makes a joke out of really dark humour, so I quite like that. But it's sort of the first time you see how science can affect people around you. And it's a very nasty scene with Tegan's aunt, sort of horrific. It's not really Doctor Who territory we've been in before, really.
Yes, I don't think I understood at a really young age how horrific it was supposed to be in the TV version. You know, I did actually love the idea of dolls, but as you get a little bit older and you realise how these people were turned into that state of being, it's horrific.
Oh, it's totally horrific, because the Master goes about killing people. He's not killing people because they're sort of still there, so it's a very nasty way he goes about killing people.
In the middle of the story, we have the TARDIS itself shrinking with the Doctor within it, don't we?
Oh yeah, that's a really nice bit. I really liked it in the book, because it's a really fantastic way of being, you know, where he's being stretched, it's like a mushroom and everything. I really like the bit of the TARDIS get it's sort of stretched down. It's, you know, and I like the fact it's due to sort of maths and logic when it gets back to normal size.
A great example, really, of how a great example of how the Target books are able to flesh out these stories, because the shrinking TARDIS is more or less done and dusted within about 10 minutes in the TV story.
Most definitely. That's the thing I think this book, in one way, struggles with, also is good, because it sort of expands a lot for it, where you look at the TV episodes and stuff will take like 6 chapters in the books, done in about 2 episodes.
Whereas the wonders of CGI we saw in Peter Capaldi's first season in Flatline, didn't we? We had the repeated effort of the TARDIS being shrunk, and that was done so well with modern technology.
Oh, yeah, I know. I was watching the commentary on Logopolis with Tom and Christopher H. Big, and he's, you know, sort of making a joke out, saying, oh, it's a tiny actor. Well, it's like modern technology. We can do anything these days with it.
But saying that, I think it still works in the TV version. They still did what they could at the time, and it is still convincing enough.
I think it works well. I've watched it earlier, and it does look quite good still. It looks quite worrying for the Doctor's character being stuck in there, so I think it does work.
Controversy in this story amongst some fans is how the Doctor has the basic idea. He doesn't actually go through with it because of the TARDIS's navigation system materialises it slightly away from where it needs to be in the Thames. Is the fact he wants to flush the Master out of the TARDIS?
Well, why don't people like that? Because I think it's quite a good idea, really.
Yes, I think there's just general scientific debates about how a TARDIS has landed within a TARDIS, within another TARDIS, isn't it? Also, within a police box. And how it would actually go about. Would the Doctor wash absolutely everything else out as well, or just the Master?
I suppose so. And also, you know, this whole theory of time rams that we mentioned in other sort of Doctor Who books, where you put a TARDIS inside a TARDIS, it doesn't like it, basically. And you've got this bit where you've got 3 different things in the one area.
Thankfully, continuity's perhaps got people out of that issue, but it does serve a purpose, the fact that it doesn't materialise in the right part of the Thames, in that we see the Watcher on one of the bridges in London, don't we?
serves this sort of, you know, for the Doctor to see the Watcher for the first time. I think it works well. And that, there's a great, lovely shots and TV version of those bits, and it's nicely described in the book as well, I think.
To the main characters, I think the Doctor takes a bit of a backseat, really, doesn't he?
I would definitely think that, because you've got the joyous fun of having too many people in the TARDIS just starting with this story, and I think come together, the sort of Doctor's in control by the end, but I think at the beginning of the book he's sort of not too sure what's going to happen to him.
Got a new member of the TARDIS team, her first appearance, Tegan. What do you make of her? I think she's a voice that needs to be heard. Obviously she's very loud, very abrasive, perhaps stereotypically of the time Australian. What did you make of her introduction to the team?
Well, I think it's a good introduction, but it's the whole going round in circles a bit annoys me with the, you know, when she's sort of in the TARDIS without knowing it. And, well, I think overall Tegan's got a good entry. I think it worked. I think she would have been quite good with gets this episode story with Tom, but I think it would have been better if she'd had more with the Fourth Doctor, I think.
Talking of Adric, Al, as well, are you sort of, he's a bit of a Marmite character, are you on the, I would say the loving or hating side, or do you find sort of middle ground with him in certain stories? I find middle ground with him in certain stories where I think he stands out as a better written character than in others.
I think I'm with you. I think I am in the middle of Adric, because there's a lot of times when I think, why is he there? And you know, there's great bits I was watching on the commentary of Tom Baker's going, yeah, I could have quite easily throttled him in some scenes. So we all know what, you know, there wasn't much love by the end between him and Matthew. So I'm like you, I'm sort of in the middle. I think if he gets a good reason for him being there, then it's good.
Yeah, I think the Doctor is quite, because he's quite subdued about what's to come in the near future, I think he's a little more fatherly to Adric in this story.
Yeah, I think there's more, you know, sort of better relationship between the two, because the Doctor knows it's his last time in that sort of body. So I think, you know, he's trying to tidy up everything. And there's bits in the book where he makes, by being angry, sort of try and get rid of all three of them from coming back in the TARDIS later. So I think it works.
Yes, well described. One of the differences in the book is the idea of the cloister room. Apparently in the original script, Christopher H. Bidmead wrote that he'd like to have it as a sort of open-air set of cloisters, and he wanted to try and film it in one of the courtyards of the Oxford or Cambridge universities.
I think it works, but I think that actually in the book it's better described, and it feels more lavish in the book, but it sort of semi-works in the TV thing, I think.
Yes, and we reached a really lavish stage, didn't we, with the McGann TV movie, returning us to the cloister room. That's a fabulous set.
Oh, I really think that set works in the McGann movie. That is what I think they were trying to do with this, but just didn't have it then. The one in the McGann movie is fantastic.
Yes, also the first time we hear the cloister bell, which has become pretty central to the new series version, 21st Century Doctor Who. Doctor Who.
Yeah, I think it has become more important over the years, and I think it will again, but I don't know if it works or doesn't work really in this episode.
Yeah, one character I do wonder about, a bit of a spare part to me, is Nyssa. I suppose the meaning is to get her to Legopolis from Traken in the previous story, have a bit of continuity with the fact that the Master has stolen her father's body. What did you make of Nyssa in this story, Al?
I think she works. I think I quite like the bits where she's being controlled by the Master. But like you, I think the connection from Kibo Traken to this story is really flimsy. Like, you know, why would she be there? And sort of, you know, why is she there? Sort of whole thing on Legopolis. I think it is really flimsy, to be honest.
Yes, and another thing about Tegan is you get a sense of her idea of social awareness, social justice, don't you? Because she describes the big sort of computer room on Legopolis as being like a sweatshop, that she'd call it back home.
The idea that these sort of people are sort of being controlled and are sort of working like in a sweatshop from, I think she wanted to say that it was going to be a Brisbane, you know, sweatshop where they cut that out, apparently.
No, I think she does say that in the TV version.
Does she
have
to
as
say
well?
That? Yeah. I was watching earlier.
If it was in the book or not. Let us know, folks. Tweet us at @DWTargetFiles. We'd love some feedback.
Most definitely.
Yes, I was wondering about the issue of Tegan saying that, Al, because she was referenced, wasn't she, Tegan, in the Sarah Jane Adventures episode at the end where she's fighting for Aboriginal rights? And that's the last.
Oh, yeah, she is mentioning that. I think that she was meant to be another. I don't know if it ever really comes out because she got, you know, the whole angry thing all the time, but I think she was meant to be more of a freedom sort of person with her character. I don't know if it actually came across.
Covers for this novelisation, Al. The first edition, published 21st of October 1982, was drawn by Andrew Skilletar, our old friend Andrew. Just the master on this one, Al. A prominent picture of Anthony Ainley's incarnation in his black tunic with his nice collar, gold collar, with a picture of the Pharos Project or Legopolis Project satellite behind, with a few rocks representing Legopolis. Quite sort of palely drawn. It's a fairly decent one, lacking the Doctor again, of course. It does have the correct Doctor Who logo for the Tom Baker, Peter Davison era on it. Your thoughts on that, Al?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, actually, because that sort of doesn't have the Doctor, but it sort of has everything else, I suppose. That's pretty good, I'd say.
And I may need to be corrected here, folks. I only have the edition I managed to get. It's a 1990s reprint. It has the Sylvester McCoy logo in a black ribbon, again at the top. A very well-drawn picture of Tom with a sort of orange background. Tegan underneath him within the same sort of pattern. Nyssa to one side, Adric there, and the... What's the name of the general guy on Legopolis? Is he the controller?
The monitor.
The monitor drawn on top of a picture of the TARDIS. It's an Alistair Pearson cover. Yes, it's very prominent. Tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah, I think it does say everything. That's quite good as well.
So there's not a lot between these two covers for me, really, Al. We also had
the first one doesn't say as much as the second one, I'd say.
And the audiobook cover's a bit different again. It looks a little bit photoshopped to me, just the Doctor and the Master together in front of the symbol for Legopolis. So I think possibly I'd go for the Alistair one, being a little bit biased again, Alistair in the middle, or maybe he'd just shade it ahead of the original Andrew Skilletar one.
I think the second one is slightly better, because it sort of tells you more about the story, I suppose.
Yeah, but fabulous work on these covers. All the people who contributed. Love the exhibition last year, which is currently apparently in the Doctor Who Experience in Cardiff. But that'll sadly be closing this summer, folks. So get along there while you can.
I don't understand why. We do know why, but it's just not a good idea.
Yes, and perhaps they'll end up somewhere else. Hopefully we'll have another major exhibition of them in the future.
That would be good. It's a brilliant artwork.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hi there, this is Alex, and this is Who's News on the 13th of January. There's been some announcements on new audiobook versions of a couple of more Target novelisations. First one is Galaxy 4. This is a first Doctor novelisation story, and should be hopefully released in July. No reader announced yet. In October, we're also getting a release of the great classic Genesis of the Daleks, Fourth Doctor audiobook. No announcer mentioned yet, but hopefully somebody interesting reading that. We also now have in the BBC One slot on a Monday night at 10:40, Class, the spin-off from Doctor Who, was originally only online, but now is in a regular Monday slot. This is making Class get more viewers. It didn't do brilliantly online, but now has got great new figures. First episode got highest ratings in the slot on Monday night. The main news that we need to mention from BigFinish.com is they finally have Byrne Gorman back playing Owen in Torchwood. It's going to be a new story out in July, and it's called Corpse Days.
So, Al, should we talk about the audiobook release
indeed,
of his novelisation read by the author Christopher H. Bidmead. What did you make of his performance and the use of sound effects, Al, the whole soundscape, and generally overall on this audiobook version?
It's got a very good soundscape. It's got sort of good noises and sounds that connect you to the episodes. But I'm not too sure about Christopher H. Bidmead's reading of the audiobook, to be honest. It was quite dry, and it didn't seem to have much differentiation between the sort of women and men, and I don't know where he was getting Tom's performance from, because it was pretty out there, and then unfortunately quite stereotypical Australian voices for Tegan, so it didn't really do anything for me. I thought it was quite dry, and it unfortunately spoiled the great line at the end of the book, really, to be honest. So it wasn't that good, but overall Christopher H. Bidmead does read it with some passion, so it's not bad.
I disagree to a certain extent. I do agree about the soundscape's very good. The sort of orchestral, almost church, maybe even gothic music towards the beginning at the end to emphasise the cloister room at the beginning and the regeneration at the end. I kind of liked the regeneration, the take on it at the end. I thought it was fairly atmospheric. I thought he read it in a very measured way. So yeah, Chris Bidmead managed to add a sort of certain atmosphere to certain parts of the book. He ramped up possible excitement when he needed to, possibly like a bit of an excited teacher. You know, we've had the scientific conversation earlier on about the scientific themes in this book. They seem to really sort of greatly excite him, and that does come across in his enthusiasm for those concepts in the book. I would agree with you about some of the performances of the characters. There's not too much differentiation. You can struggle to understand for a moment who is actually speaking the lines. So, not a bad one overall. I would give it a listen. You know, one you've really got to focus and concentrate on because of the scientific themes. Perhaps, you know, it's just the fact that Chris Bidmead isn't really a natural performer. He is more of a journalist, more of a writer.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I did think that the scientific parts were quite interesting. It was certainly one you couldn't sort of sit down and flick through, and you had to sort of spend quite a few hours actually getting to grips with it. But I do think it's a good book, and I think it, you know, it's, as we all know, it's one of the best stories for regen. It's generation, it's Tom's final hour, really, and it's a very good book, but I just felt it was a bit too scientific in some places.
Yeah, it needs to strike that balance, really, doesn't it? I think, as we said before, Doctor Who can be a certain format one week, it could be a musical even one week. We haven't got there yet. It could be heavy on the science the next week, like this. So certainly in the modern series. So if we move out towards, it's got to be said, the end. But that moment has been prepared for in this podcast.
I know. The end is very, well, I love it in a TV episode. The end is just brilliant with Tom, and you know, that sort of transformation from Tom to Peter works so well.
But did you like the fact that Peter's Doctor got a line at the end of this book? I quite enjoyed that addition.
Yeah, I really liked that. I think that actually made the regen a little bit more connective, if you see what I mean. I just think, because normally it's like, you know, he changes into the next Doctor and that's all you see, and then it cuts to the credits. But I thought that sort of extra connection between the old and new was really good.
Yes, because Davison just sits up, doesn't he, and smiles in the TV version.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, I don't know if those sort of regens work for me. It might just be, I quite like ones where you get quite dialogue-y, like, that's why I really like Matt, you know, from David Tennant to Matt Smith. I thought that really worked.
I think it fits in with a sombre tone more, that it's just a gentle handover, really, in this one.
I think it needed to be quite somber, because, you know, you've had the same Doctor for so long, and then it's like people had to get to grips with Peter David. I expect, you know, for the first year, people weren't, you know, did you find it difficult to change over, or not really?
Do you mean actual Tom from Pop?
Tom, not Tom to Tom to Peter, you know, sort of that whole, you had Tom for,
well,
so
being
long,
my,
and it went to Peter.
Being my first, very first lifetime memory as a very small child, I don't actually think that I noticed Tom's Doctor much in this story, being so young. I almost thought it was a sort of adventure series about Adric and Tegan, because Tom and Nyssa really sort of took a backseat in this story. So to me, sort of, the Doctor turned up at the end in terms of being Peter and solved it all in time for Castrovalva, the next story. Yeah, it wasn't a big deal to me to be a change at the time. I think Davison to Cronenberger was a much harsher change for me in terms of, you know, the attempted strangling of Perry in the first episode, and I possibly lost a lot of faith with Doctor Who at that time because of that.
Whole change from David Tennant to Matt Smith, and I will say this, as you probably knew, I did not like Matt Smith for the whole first year of his season. I absolutely thought what is going on, it did take me a whole year. So I think that can happen with Doctors.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, Matt just did get it for me. To be honest, I was hooked by the midway through the 11th hour. I thought he was superb throughout. But, you know, a lot of people weren't necessarily ready for that change.
I just didn't get it. Everybody, you know, we go to conventions and that, everybody reads him and going, you know, he's the best. And I'm just going, no. And then suddenly it just clicked when I worked out he could do every Doctor.
Pretty much. There's sort of so many elements of other Doctors in there, isn't there? But anyway, wanting to get back 30 years again, Al, to the book we're talking about, Legopolis. Yeah. Your overall thoughts and your final scores.
Well, I think pretty good book. It has a few niggles in my case. I think it's too scientific. But in a way, I think that's a good thing because it sort of stretches your mind, and Doctor Who needs that occasionally. It sort of needs you to go off in different, weird, wonderful ways. So I would give the book probably a 7. Audiobook, unfortunately, was spoiled for me because it was a bit too dry again. So probably give the audiobook a 6, probably.
Very, very scientific. Sciencey-wiencey, as you might say in the modern parlance. Or maybe not. Good introduction of Tegan, a very strong, forceful character. Great addition to the team. Not so sure about the need for Nissa to return. Doctor having more of a paternal relationship with Adric in this story. In turn, that makes Adric a little less sort of cumbersome and annoying than in future stories. Builds together nicely. Bidmead expands certain things, like, as we said, the TARDIS being shrunken. Expands the regeneration a little bit with a first line for Peter's Doctor. I did enjoy this book. I'd give it probably a 7 for both, Al. A 7 for the novelisation and a 7 for the audiobook and performance.
Oh, well, that's good then. It just, I think, like you, it was just a bit too dry for me, but I can see the point of it. We've had it recently with, like, Peter Davison, Peter Capaldi episode where it was just him. And that sort of, some people love it, some people hate it. So people's choice, really.
I'd like to add the word intriguing to this book because I suppose with the scientific nature of it, it could have been boring, couldn't it? It could have got a little bit cumbersome, but it does hold your attention as long as you're willing to put the concentration in.
Definitely. It's not ridiculously dry if you actually sit there and listen to it. There are bits to keep you going. There's lots of action and entertainment around the science, but there is an awful lot of complicated science.
Fair enough, but as we said many times already in this recording, Doctor Who can be all things for all people from week to week, folks. So
Most definitely.
A good one overall, Al.
Yeah, I would agree. Very worth the listen.
Next time, The Target Files, we'll be discussing Earthshock, written by Ian Marta, and the audiobook read by Peter Davison and Nicholas Briggs. Doctor Who Target Files Legopolis Review featured Michael Winks and Alexander Gibbons. I Am the Doctor, originally composed by Murray Gold. Version for this podcast by YouTube channel Ruling Terror 42. Check out that channel, folks. Newsround opening and closing theme originally composed by John Baker and by Ted Heath and his orchestra. Legopolis incidental music originally composed by Paddy Kingsland. No copyright infringement intended on any of the music used in this podcast. If you'd like to get in contact with the podcast, tweet us at DWTargetFiles, all lowercase. Doctor Who Target Files Legopolis Review was recorded in Exeter, Devon, England, and Swansea, Wales, UK, during January 2017.